Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, delighted to welcome you to episode 2481 of The Tom Woods Show with Dr. Harvey Risch, who is Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology in the Department of Epidemiology and Public Health at the Yale School of Public Health and Yale School of Medicine. I think it's safe to say that Dr. Risch became, let's say, unintentionally, much more of a national name and, let's say, lightning rod and source of controversy, none of which he expected, certainly in 2020, but all of which happened. So, Dr. Risch, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be with you.
I want to just start off by just asking you a couple of personal questions about your experiences, if I may, and I'm sure you've been through this before, but when I have people like Jay Bhattacharya on the show, I just can't help but ask them, especially because I'm sure you know Jay Bhattacharya. I mean, he's a very soft-spoken person. I mean, he's not a confrontational sort of person by constitution, let's say, and yet he's been thrust into the public eye for saying things that I think he assumed were just commonplaces, and all of a sudden he's stirred up all this controversy. And I guess I'd like to know a little bit about what's happened to you in terms of your relationship with your colleagues, because Dr. Bhattacharya has been quite alienated from people who have been really good friends to him over the years. So what's this been like?
Well, I'd say I've had a similar experience in that regard, that I'm basically a scientist. I study the way nature works. I report on it in scientific publications, try to translate that into English for lay people, and try to just do as an objective job the best I can. And I've always been that way. And I'm not going to lie that nature says something other than what I think it says. I can be wrong on occasion, but that's different than knowing something and saying something else. And so at the beginning of the pandemic, I got involved because I'm a member of the Connecticut Academy of Science and Engineering, and we had struck a committee to help advise the governor of Connecticut about how to end the lockdowns. And we weren't the governor's official committee. We were a second kind of a committee with a little bit of out-of-the-box kind of people. We had a couple physicists, cardiologists, two epidemiologists, myself and my dean at Yale, a clinical psychologist, a jet engine designer who knows how to airflow considerations, things like that. And my job was to look at early outpatient treatment. And so I did, and I wrote up a very extensive analysis of what was available at the time. This was in May of 2020, and I published that. And I thought, well, this is just science. Why should this be anything contrarian or whatever? And I did not think that I would get the reception that it did. Now, what happened first was, you know, I've published studies for 40 years of career and know that reporters pick up on things and lots of times get things wrong. So I always offer to review anything they, you know, they want to put out if they want me to do that before they put out written statements, say. So I know that things can be wrong. And so when I started seeing responses in the media to the paper that were nonsensical, I started at first thinking, well, it's reporters being reporters. But after it was systematic, became systematically nonsensical, then I realized there was something systematic going on that was, you know, related to something that I didn't understand. This was that I was talking about early treatment in people outside of the hospital within the first 3 or 4 days, people at high risk of doing poorly with COVID infection. And the responses were, oh, but it doesn't work in hospital studies. And I thought, well, this is crazy. Why would they quote hospital studies? I didn't say anything about hospital studies. I said outpatients. And this became systematic, as I said, and I knew that something was going on that was different than just a different opinion about the science.
But that really does provoke a question, doesn't it? That what exactly is going on? So this isn't just a matter of people have some kind of disagreement in the way you interpret the data. This is just they're making a category mistake of some kind. And it can't just be that they're dumb. So what could have been happening? Was it groupthink? Or like, how do we account for this?
Well, you know, this became very systematic, not just to me and hydroxychloroquine or to the great Barrington Declaration people like Dr. Bhattacharya. It started happening to doctors who had personal experience treating hundreds or thousands of patients. outpatients with hydroxychloroquine, seeing astonishingly good results of keeping those people alive. And yet we're told, don't believe your lying eyes, that we experts in the universities know much better than you do, even though we've never treated any COVID patients. And the hubris was astonishing and pointed to some common forces above them dictating what they should or shouldn't say. It did become politicized when President Trump in March of 2020 said hydroxychloroquine is a great drug and we should be using it. And everybody hopped onto the anti-Trump bandwagon. If Trump says it, we do the opposite.
Yeah.
But the forces against us had been arrayed well before he said anything. That in late 2019, I think November of 2019, the Minister of Health in France had changed the status of hydroxychloroquine from over-the-counter to prescription only. And she cited bogus claims of genotoxicity, meaning that it could damage genetic material in people, when this drug and or its forebear chloroquine had been used for 60 plus years in tens of billions of doses worldwide and hundreds of millions of people without ever a worry. This is a drug that around the world is almost all over the counter. And so France suddenly woke up to that something causing it to change their opinion. Well, the French knew that the drug worked because CDC author Vincent put out a paper in 2005 showing that chloroquine was effective at physiologic doses that would work in people against SARS-CoV-1. So they already knew that it was a candidate drug to be treating the coronavirus. And so this was all known, and the pandemic itself was apparently known to the French research infrastructure. Don't forget that the French company bioMérieux had built the Wuhan Institute of Virology's BSL-4 lab that was finished in 2017, commissioned in 2018, that the deputy CEO or CEO of the company, Stefan Bancel, who became the CEO of Moderna, had been involved with the Wuhan Institute of Virology people, that they all knew that this was coming. This was all part of what they were planning for. And so this was set up well before President Trump said anything.
Of course, you're familiar with Alex Berenson.
Yes.
Okay. So Alex Berenson, I assume most people listening also know, was very much a critic of the lockdown and masking policies. And he sometimes would defend doctors who had been marginalized unjustly. But when it came to this particular question, I think the way he addressed doctors who disagreed with him was quite uncharitable and uncharacteristically so. Did he have anything that made you think twice about what you were seeing?
Well, no, actually, because when I published a paper in May of 2020, there were only 5 studies and collected large case series of clinician reports. But over the next 6 to 9 months, another 4 or 5 large studies came out, including more than 70,000 patients treated with hydroxychloroquine, showing the dramatic benefit that it has against mortality. This is in the pre-Omicron era, which I could speak to if you want. But at that time, it was overall reducing mortality from this infection by 75%, fourfold reduced risk of dying from COVID. That's a dramatic benefit for basically a harmless drug that costs 40 cents a tablet, you know, 80 cents a day to use.
I've asked this question of a couple other people you probably know. I think I asked it of Joseph Latipo and also of Dr. McCullough, but I said, if I were to have asked you in 2019, what do you think are some of the problems that need to be addressed within the American medical establishment? What would your answer have been then? And what would your answer be here in 2024?
Well, in 2019, I was completely naive about everything. You know, I probably should have read Peter Gotch's book from 2013 that talks about, he calls pharma a mafia. He's got a 300-page book all discussing all of the shenanigans and things that they've done to create doubt when their drugs were harmful, and using the tobacco company playbook. And this has been going on for a long time. We know that the medical publishing apparatus system has been tainted to some degree by pharma before COVID, to the point that the editors of the New England Journal and Lancet all complained about it, that they couldn't get objective information out on, you know, safety and efficacy of medications through the randomized trials process. But we didn't really think that much about it, that it just wasn't so obvious that this was creating major damage against the medical knowledge and the care of patients. I will say, however, that a couple of things did register in my consciousness well before the pandemic. This was that when the whole field of evidence-based medicine was proclaimed in 1991, I thought that was hubris and an affront to epidemiology as a whole, saying that only randomized controlled trials would provide reliable evidence for the efficacy of medications. And this continued for a while. And I started teaching a course in pharmacoepidemiology, the epidemiology of drugs and devices and vaccines and their predisposing conditions for using those things. And as part of this, I re-engaged with randomized controlled trials, and I had an epiphany in 2018 that randomization doesn't work well unless you have 50 or 100 people in each outcome group. And I thought, oh, well, how come nobody's ever said this? So, of course, I Googled it and looked up in PubMed and other medical databases of publications and found indeed that this had been discussed by one very senior statistician economist at Princeton in 2018, the same year that I thought about it, saying that randomized trials have to be large, and not just large in the number of patients that go into the studies, like 20,000 vaccine patients and 20,000 placebo in a randomized trial of vaccines, but the number of people who are the event people have to be large. So the 162 infections in the Pfizer trial versus 8 in the placebo group versus 8 in the vaccine group, well, 8 is not a randomized number. And I started saying that randomization doesn't work. And to say that randomized trials automatically get the status of gold standard is a complete misrepresentation of the scientific quality of that work. And there's much more that goes along with that as to why randomized trials are not necessarily a gold standard and how they can be manipulated and influenced to convey a pharma message that isn't necessarily a scientific one. And so this had already popped up in my radar in 2018, but it didn't really wasn't writ large, so to speak, until the vaccines came out. And there were all these proclamations about how good the vaccines were working in randomized trials, and yet how bad they were working once you got 6 months into their rollout in the U.S. and other countries.
So you've been in epidemiology, and I can't help asking. I mean, my PhD is in history, and I'll be the first to tell you that the field of history is full of weirdos and terrible work and embarrassing scholarship. I mean, I'll be the first to admit it's in terrible shape. But I wonder if you think, not just public health in general or the medical establishment in general, but is there anything wrong with epidemiology, or maybe I should say epidemiologists, given that so many of them seem to be, I don't know, hypochondriacs or something? Like, for example, the Washington Post in 2020 did a survey. It was a small sample size, I grant you, but a survey of epidemiologists asking, which of the following things would you feel comfortable doing right now? And then they revisited it a few months down the road. And it was things like going out to have a meal or going out to check your mail. And it was like a third of them didn't want to go out and check their mail. I mean, what do you think's going on here? Is there something wrong with the field, or is it just these people, or what?
Well, I think that if you asked any group of highly educated people in technical subjects, for example, you'd get the same result.
That's probably true, yes.
But interestingly, about 1990, I was at an annual meeting of the Society for Epidemiologic Research, which is one of the professional societies of epidemiology. And I was a young epidemiologist at the time. And I was sitting in a meeting where the speaker asked a room of about 50 epidemiologists, said, how many of you believe that supplements are useful for improving health? And nobody raised their hand. And then asked, how many of you take daily supplements to improve your health? And almost everybody raised their hand. So you can understand that people's anxieties can be a lot different than what they think and are willing to espouse publicly and rationally.
Okay, well, that's an interesting point. By the way, before I forget, I'm supposed to mention this in all my episodes. So as I don't want to upset my old friend Gene Epstein. So let me, if you wouldn't mind, pause to tell people, I'm actually debating the subject of COVID policy from a public policy angle, not the medical angle, at the Soho Forum in New York City, April 23rd. And if you're interested in coming to see that, the website is thesohoforum.org. Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Persist SEO. If you are getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO. If you are a small local business trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, then increase your visibility with Persist SEO. What if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis? Well, then website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. Are you tired of cold calling and networking, meeting places getting shut down? Use your website as a lead generation engine. Or what if you're not showing up for your services in the search engines? Well, get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. Let's say then, moving past epidemiology for a moment, something about public health in general. Now, I don't know the origins of public health as a separate category within medicine, but I rather suspect that it originated, as one of my listeners said, with, you know, making sure that there wasn't horse manure all over the streets and, you know, trying to get rid of mosquitoes and stuff like that. But that has it morphed beyond a matter of, well, let's try to do some things that are clear and obvious in terms of sanitation and other obvious measures we can take that would be of benefit to everybody, to now a matter of, well, now we're going to be breathing down your neck, telling you how you should live and what decisions you should make.
So I agree with you. Public health started off as sanitation and hygiene and played a great role in improving standards of living in the United States and Western countries over the last 100 or 150 years. And I think that credibility has been potentially damaged by the excesses of what's happened in public health, to the point where I see in my institution and probably other institutions in our Masters in Public Health, MPH program, where a large majority of the enrollees are people who see public health as a tool for bettering political questions. So they see the opportunity to medicalize things like poverty or other political questions. And once they medicalize these issues, then they claim public health authority to intervene in those things using public health tools, which are very poorly regulated, as we know from what's happened in COVID, that there's very little in the way of checks and balances in the public health industry. So these are activist people looking to solve problems rather than science people looking to figure out how nature works and use that.
Well, certainly if you make a remark like racism is a public health issue, so that's why it's all right in June of 2020 for people to be out protesting when 5 minutes ago we just told them not to do that, shows there's something other than medicine motivating these people.
Well, that's right. That's what I said, that public health is a tool for social activism.
Yeah,
I believe it's overused in that way and needs some reflection about its proper engagement with society. That our epidemiology training obviously is not doing all that well, because you see in things like papers written by CDC personnel. So these are serious scientists, MD and MPH and PhD scientists, writing papers on vaccine efficacy. When they do a study in one study design and analyze it by a different study design and overestimate the results by dramatic amounts. So some of the studies that looked at the COVID vaccines claiming 85% efficacy turn out to have, when you analyze them correctly, turn out to have 55% efficacy. These are dramatic differences, and it's because they didn't recognize that the study analysis that they used was inappropriate for the study design that they used. Any first-year epidemiology student should have been able to recognize what the study design was and what the analysis was, and their assumptions about what they did in using that analysis were flawed. Seriously flawed. And yet they fit the authors on these papers and they still do it. So is this incompetence, or are they all aligning to a narrative that is coming from top down? You know, it's very difficult to say.
Well, I'm sure you're aware that there are a lot of Americans now, a minority, but a lot of them, who really are attributing sinister motives to some of these people because they can't imagine that it could just be stupidity. I'll give you an example. Maybe it was late 2022, early 2023, somewhere around then, where the White House and I think also the CDC were warning. This is around the time, so I guess we can time it by when they were really pushing to get the youngest cohort vaccinated, they were saying that COVID was a top five killer of children. And anybody even casually familiar with what had been going on knew that was false, had to be false. And it was a lay woman, Kelly Cronert, who pointed out the problems with the data, and eventually they had to retract it. And I ended up getting in a, oddly enough, a Twitter exchange with Jerome Adams. I don't know why he's jumping into my thing, but he was saying, well, you know, everybody makes mistakes and all that. And I said, but you know what? But no, this is not a mistake. This would be like a football player not knowing what a safety is. You know, this is not a mistake that you make. How does something like this happen? And I think some people are concluding it can't be stupidity, because we're actually giving them the benefit of the doubt by saying we don't think you're stupid. We just think you're up to something. We just don't know what it is. So that's what quote-unquote public health has now done to its reputation.
I agree with you. When it's not limited, is when you have a Supreme Court justice who says that 360 million Americans have died from COVID, you know, and things like that. That's just absurd that the people have common sense knowledge of the world and yet say things that if they took 1 second to think, could that be true, they would recognize can't be true. I think that there's more to this, and I've said this in essays and publicly now, that you have to realize that when COVID pandemic erupted, this didn't happen in a vacuum, and the management of it was not a public health management. President Trump handed off the management of the pandemic to the National Security Council, which is a military umbrella organization that took control of running the pandemic management. Why would this be a military management of something that should be public health? They threw out what we already knew of public health respiratory virus management. This was written by Inglesby and Don Henderson, who was the father of smallpox eradication, who published in 2006, basically a manual of the state of the art of pandemic respiratory virus pandemic management. And in 2020, this was basically flipped on its head, and mostly everything was done backwards to what happened then. And all of the things that the indignities, as I put it, the lockdowns, the masking, the vaccination, the school closures, the business closures, all of these things that were essentially damaging to our society were not the things that were described to do in a public health, in a respiratory virus pandemic. And yet we did this anyway. And the only reason that I can see that this was militarily inflicted on us is because of that we created the virus in the first place. And we know that this is actually the case, even though there was massive cover-up of the origins of the virus, because it's been written about in scientific publications that Ralph Baruch at University of North Carolina invented the genetic manipulation tools to change these SARS types of coronaviruses from ones that infect more or less bats to ones that can infect people. And he trained Chinese investigators, Chinese scientists, to use his methods. They went back to China at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and they used his methods to experiment on these bat coronaviruses until one got transformed enough that it could infect humans. And then some of those scientists became the apparent first cases of COVID, and it leaked out from there. And we know it leaked out from there because the initial cases in China all follow the Shanghai subway 2 line, or the Wuhan subway 2 line, that goes from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, or passes by the Wuhan Institute of Virology and goes to the Wuhan International Airport. So we have information, and there's way more information than that, that the intelligence people know about, that implicates that that's where it came out, that this was a lab-engineered virus. It's proven biologically that we know that, for example, there's a long sequence, genetic sequence in the COVID virus that includes the furin cleavage site and a second, what's called the enzyme landing pad site, that is in a Moderna patent from 2017. And there's no way this could have gotten into the virus just on its own without human involvement. So we know that the thing was bioengineered, and essentially we know who did it and where and how and all of that. And so then there's this big massive cover-up as to the lab origin. Why was there a need for this cover-up? The answer is because the virus was developed using bioengineering tools to make a gain-of-function virus, which violated the 1975 Bioweapons Treaty. Gerald Ford, President Ford, signed the bioweapons treaty in 1975, saying that it was prohibited for signatory countries to develop gain of function bioweapons. And the only loophole in that was that small amounts could be made for the purpose of making vaccines. And so there was never, in the almost 50 years between then and COVID, there was never a bioweapon vaccine that was the result of bioweapons research. Sure, there were lots of vaccines made over that time period, but none of them were made from bioweapons organisms that were made in order to make vaccines. And then COVID comes along and it escapes. And where's the vaccine? Where's the vaccine that was supposed to have been made for this virus that would have complied with the 1975 bioweapons treaty? Well, there wasn't one. So it became of the utmost crucial importance to demonstrate a vaccine that was the supposed end product of the bioweapons research. And so what I see of this, my understanding is that this is just my opinion, is that the whole response to the pandemic has been to protect the bioweapons industry. That when the public understands that this virus was made for the purpose of making a bioweapon, that there was no vaccine that was the end result until the thing leaked. And then the industry was forced to make a vaccine in response in order to claim that it was complying with the treaty, that this was illegal research being done against the bioweapons treaty, and we should be shutting down all of that gain-of-function research. And so the military response was to protect its bioweapons asset. And that's what was in control of the pandemic.
So Anthony Fauci is just outright lying?
Oh, yes. He's a sociopath. He's outright lying.
Well, here's another question then, similar to an earlier one I asked. What would you have said about Fauci in 2019?
Well, what I knew about Fauci in 2019 is what he did in 1987 to 1989 in the AIDS epidemic, where he refused to espouse the antibiotic Bactrim for the prevention of pneumocystis pneumonia in gay people with AIDS. And this was something that clinicians in New York City knew was very effective in keeping them from dying of this pneumonia. And they went to Fauci and they said, look, we don't want you to state formally that this is the approved treatment. We want you to just say, clinicians, you be out there, you should be able to use this if you think it appropriate. And Fauci said, in foretelling of what he would say a generation later, bring me multiple large, high-quality randomized trials before I'm willing to say anything. And of course, NIH, NIAID didn't fund any of these trials. The gay community in New York City raised the money to carry out a three-year trial, randomized trial themselves, after 3 years had shown that this medication worked. In the meantime, Fauci was espousing AZT as the treatment. AZT is a very toxic drug. It kills people and requires other medications to keep the drug from killing people, and didn't work for preventing pneumonia all that well. And that's what Fauci was pushing in the meantime. So this paradigm of Fauci's response to major epidemic considerations is he always goes on the side of corporate or financial interest, not on the side of medical evidence.
Mm. Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, because I would say this is, and this is just my opinion, I would say the gay community was extraordinarily forgiving from 2020 onward. I mean, some of them criticized him in the 80s, but it was like that was all water under the bridge, because I saw no organized, I mean, even People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals protested Fauci after 2020 because of his animal experiments. At least they had some dignity. But it was like, oh yeah, you know, a lot of us died because of your crazy decisions. But, you know, hey, today we're all in this together, right? I cannot get over how people could just overlook what was done at that time.
I agree with you completely.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here with a message about my mastermind, which is set to begin its second year. And I'd like to know if you belong in that room with us. We have a member who's in corporate, but most of the people in the mastermind are running their own businesses. So maybe you're doing well, but you could be doing better. You want to bounce ideas off smart, successful people and get the kind of feedback that takes you and your business to the proverbial next level. Well, that's what the Tom Woods Mastermind is all about. We meet 3 times a year, each time in a different city. We dig deep into your business and give very specific, actionable advice. It's a small group, so we can give you lots of individual attention. Connections and partnerships also emerge. People are reporting great results. Two members just entered into a potentially multi-million dollar partnership. We've also become great friends, and I'm all for the work hard, play hard philosophy, so we enjoy great food and entertainment together, all of which is included in the package. We're not interested in growing by 5%. We're interested in moving everyone up to that proverbial next level where they, perhaps you, dream of being but can't quite get there on their own. Now, masterminds are not cheap. Price them for yourself and see, and they're not for everyone. But for the right person, they are life-changing. As Henry Bingaman, who's a member of the mastermind, puts it, sometimes you have to pay to be in the room. Almost every dollar of income in my copywriting career I can trace back to a handshake somewhere. Ready to open a new chapter? Head to woodsmastermind.com, click the button, and let's talk. So how about this question? Now, I keep trying to get somebody to show me, and I don't know if the data is available or what, but I just want to see for myself the answer to the question of whether these various shots for COVID have, on balance, been a benefit. I mean, I hear a lot of stories about vaccine injury, and I've done an episode on that. And I've heard that, quote, the data say that early on, it definitely helped to prevent deaths from this particular cause in older, more vulnerable people. But then there have also been complications. I've never seen the data, so I'm not in a position, I'm agnostic on this. But I have a lot of friends who are very, very much against the shots. I just want to see, is there an objective way to just answer this question once and for all?
The answer to that is, it's very difficult because long-term consequences of something are very difficult to pin down to something that happened in the past. And I'll say how one can do that, but it's not the same way as you might think of the next day somebody died after getting the shot. Now, the other problem with this is that the vaccines activities have been transient. So in the first 6 months of rollout, there was some benefit of the vaccines in reducing risk of getting infected with COVID. And there probably was some risk reduction in risk of dying from COVID. And this applied more to the high-risk people who were at real risk of dying from COVID than the normal everyday and low-risk people who weren't. That means children in particular and young adults. Now, as time progressed, the vaccines lost their potency. The loss in potency was because their immune response declines over time and their specificity to the organisms that need to be protected from changes because the organism has mutated. You don't generally give a vaccine in the middle of a pandemic. You have to give it in advance of the pandemic to suppress the pandemic from happening. You give it in the middle and a virus that can mutate will mutate around the vaccine, and that's what happened. So over time, the vaccines lost their efficacy. So we come up with boosters and more boosters and so on, each booster providing less and less duration of benefit to the point where after the second or third boosters, we're talking of about a month to 2 months of a potential benefit, if that. So that's the benefit side. Meanwhile, mid-2021, we already knew that the vaccines were not suppressing transmission of the virus, that vaccinated people were still getting sick. Well, sure, people who'd had COVID can still get sick from COVID again, but the vaccines were touted as being 100% effective against that, and they were being seen increasingly as leaky and not working for preventing transmission to the point where by early 2022, we all were recognizing that this was a failed experiment in preventing transmission. CDC took until August of that year to be official about it. And so we knew that the vaccines were not the long-term solution, and so we still had to address the harms that they might have caused. And the problem with that is the short-term harms like myocarditis, pericarditis, which is infrequent but not zero, is not a transient problem for the people who are affected because it causes heart damage, and those people will have bad effects in their cardiac function 5, 10, 15 years later. That is the picture of myocarditis. So even those people get up from their hospital beds and leave the hospital, walk out, and lead what appear to be normal lives, their hearts have been damaged to a certain degree. And it remains to be seen how much, quantitatively speaking, you know, now going 5, 10 years later. Then we have the question of general cardiac damage and cancer risks going forward. And that will take time to see as this plays out. We now know from the insurance company data and from some initial analysis of data in working age people, so age say 16 to 64 year old people, that mortality has increased or been increasing across the board starting in 2022 or so. And does this imply that it came from the vaccines? Well, that's an explanation, but it's not proof. The only way we'll know this is sometime 5 years from now, 10 years from now, conducting large studies, what are called case control studies, where we go to people either who have gotten cancer or have died from cancer, and we interview their family members and ask them, the people with cancer, and take along control people of the same age, sex, ethnicity, and so on, and ask both sets of people, did you get vaccinated, how often, what vaccines, and so on, and then compare their prior vaccine history against the ones who got cancer and the controls who didn't. And these case control studies will show whether the vaccine was associated with getting the cancer. And this is the only way that we'll ever know this, and it won't be proof according to the randomized controlled trial people who'll demand randomized controlled trials to answer that question when that's obviously impossible to use. And so we'll end up doing multiple case control studies and using the methods that were outlined by Sir Austin Bradford Hill in 1965 for how does one determine causation from a collection of epidemiologic studies. And that's how we'll solve this question. But, you know, I won't be the person doing this 10 or 15 years from now, and I hope somebody will be doing it.
Well, you did make some mention of this excess deaths phenomenon that is observable in quite a number of countries, which of course has, you know, naturally among the public raised the question of, well, all of a sudden we get these excess deaths, what changed? And they say, well, the most obvious thing is this. But then you have other people on the other side say, oh, maybe the excess deaths are caused by complications related to long COVID. And so then people are stymied trying to get to the bottom of it.
Well, people with long COVID, many of them stopped working. They were unable to work if their long COVID was serious. However, I would agree that these kinds of what we call ecologic studies are not proof. They're evidence. And we have to put together as much of this evidence as possible. So the same time course occurring in different countries, if the vaccine rollouts occurred at slightly different time periods, then if that changed when the mortality increases changed, then we might have a little more evidence of that. Basically, you have to use whatever evidence you have and try to make a case for it and see. So it won't be proof, but it will be appreciable evidence.
The challenging thing here is that the kind of people who might conceivably do this research someday are generally going to be members of institutions, whether medical institutions or universities or whatever, that generally seem to have a vested interest in the outcome going one way or the other. And I don't like being a cynical person, but I feel like I've been forced into it.
Well, you know, I think that from my experience writing grant applications to study cancer and submitting them to NIH for funding, the question will have two audiences. The first will be the peers in the NIH review system who will think that whether the scientific question is one of merit and should be addressed. Peers in general tend to favor more about scientific questions than political or economic questions and corruptions. So there's a good chance that a proper hearing might be held for these kinds of grants at the level of the science. However, then these grants that fare really well at the scientific level percolate up to the National Institutes of Health Review Boards. That's the National Cancer Advisory Board. I'm sure NIAID has its own similar kinds of review boards where the senior staff of the institutions decide on their policy questions as to what should be addressed and what not. And that's where the sticking point might be, that if there are still allegiances between NIH and pharma, that they may say, we don't want this studied. But I would say that the fallout from doing that might be severe because the investigator will get back a statement saying, you scored in the top one percentile of your grants in scientific review, yet we've chosen not to fund your application. Okay. So they'll know that there was a political reason why this happened and not a scientific one. And this will be made public and will still be implications of corruption at the highest levels of NIH. And I think that NIH would rather, it's something that I've done as a journal reviewer, which is when you get a paper, as a journal editor for that matter, when you get a paper submitted for publication that you disagree with, you don't like it for some reason, scientifically speaking, it's better not to reject the paper outright if you think the paper really does have some merit, but approve the paper conditioned on responding to criticisms of the reviewers and the editors. And in those criticisms, put in what you think would make the paper better or more correct, and force the authors to align more with what you think should be the outcome of the paper. Why does this work? Because authors would more likely change their paper slightly to suit scientific considerations of a journal that's accepted the paper than go to find another journal and start the process all over again. And the same would be true of grants, that if you let a grant run, it's going to take 3, 5, 7 years before it comes out. That gives you a lot of time to align your forces against the results if you're afraid that something bad's going to happen, a la tobacco company kinds of playbook things. So there's a lot of ways that this could be managed without making publicly damaging actions that in that way, I think.
Well, a couple more quick things to wrap up. First is, what do you think was going on in New York City in early 2020? Was it simply a matter of nobody knew what they were dealing with, and so the response was not going to be as good as it would be later when doctors had more experience? Do you think it's just that?
I think it was a combination of things. I think, number one, people were panicking. The medical staffs were panicking. Everybody was believing in this is a calamity, that this illness is going to kill everybody. They were believing in the 10% mortality across the board that was coming out of the UK modelers, that fake modeling. So everybody had a large fear quotient, including the medical healthcare staffs. So lots of cases were being seen in hospitals. It was overloading their care abilities at certain time points. And everybody was brainwashed to think that there were no outpatient treatments. And so nobody was getting hydroxychloroquine, zinc, azithromycin, or doxycycline, and various other medications, and a whole armamentarium of things that work to treat outpatient COVID. And those are the people and people with comorbidities who desperately needed that kind of treatment to prevent them from getting in the hospital. Numbers more patients could have been treated with oxygen as outpatients and those regimens without having to be hospitalized. So there was a lot of control in the military management of the pandemic to say, we want to overload the medical system. We want to let patients die so that there will be fear, so that when the vaccines come out, people will be so afraid they will rush to take them, proving that the vaccines are the end result of what had to be accomplished in the pandemic. I think that this is the nefarious actions of our military control and the military system of managing the pandemic.
If people want to follow you these days, is Twitter the best place to do it?
I do have a Twitter channel where I post things that I write and podcasts and things that I do. Also on Telegram. And those are linked to my Yale webpage. People can find me just by Googling Risch, R-I-S-C-H, and Yale, Y-A-L-E. They'll find my Yale page and the links are there and a little bit about me and various other good things.
Okay, well, I will put that link for people who are close to a device. I'll put that in the description of the video as well as at, let's see, tomwoods.com/2481. Well, Harvey Risch, I appreciate your time. I've followed you since the very beginning. I've seen you on television numerous times, and I felt like this poor guy just seems exasperated by what is going on around him, and you know, and he's just trying to do his job, and it probably never occurred to him that just doing his job would lead to all these consequences. But you, like Jay, I think have been a good example to us, not only by sticking to your guns and being courageous, but also, like Jay, you never seem to lose your cool. That would not be me. You know, I'd fly off the handle at the first opportunity, but you never seem to lose your cool.
Well, I try. It's not easy.
Well, it's a great example to us all. So thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.